There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Today we're talking with Philbrook director Scott Stuhlen, my boss, by the way. When he's not running the museum or getting his hair cut, Scott's an artist, a DJ for hire, and a recovering baseball card addict. We sat down recently to talk about his first year on the job, this new show he's been thinking about for years, and much more. All right, here's my chat with Scott. So you've been at this museum director thing now for about a year.
About that, yeah.
It's the first time you've ever done it.
Yep.
So I wonder, what's the big surprise after a year doing this?
Well, first of all, the surprise is that I'm ever doing it to begin with, because I never thought I would be in the position of being a director of a museum. That wasn't one of those things as a kid. I'm like, you know, I'm going to seek out to be a director of an art museum. It's something that kind of evolved over time. And, you know, starting out as a visual artist and kind of moving into programmer, then to a curator, and now as a museum director. But it's been really eye-opening in some ways. Nothing I would say is a huge surprise, but some things like kind of the amount of time that it takes, and it kind of consumes your every minute of the day, some of the parts of the work, but also just how incredibly rewarding it can be too, and kind of to have the ability to think of ideas and things that you want to make happen and then have the ability to execute those and be able to do that relatively quickly too. So I think that's a unique thing of Philbrook as well.
Were you someone when you were young who was like a big planner? Did you have kind of big dreams like beyond, you know, art? You know, when you were, say, let's say when you're 15, 16 years old, what did you think you were going to be doing when you were 40?
Yes, I always had very unrealistic dreams. So I would say the 15, 16-year-old was still thinking that I was going to play professional baseball, which is totally not that I even had the skill set to do that. But I still was thinking that or be like a sports broadcaster. I was really interested in like marketing communications at that age. I still took a lot of art classes. But if you really asked me, like, you know, 16-year-old Scott, I would probably tell you like, oh, no, my band's going to make it. And that's going to be my thing.
So were you in a band at 16?
I was in a band with my brothers.
What was the band called?
I can't even remember. We had a bunch of garage band things back then. It's not that I'm hiding anything. I seriously can't remember.
Did you play guitar?
I played guitar, yeah. But sports were a big part of my life.
Do you think that it's a strange thing for a museum director to be as into sports as you are? When you're at the museum director conference where you guys meet in your underground lair, it's like a Dr. Evil kind of situation. Is there a lot of talk of sports at these things?
It's all anybody talks about. No, it's at the museum conference, like clubhouse. For the directors, I am such an anomaly on so many different levels. I am the only one of my kind in so many ways. One is the sports thing is not a big thing, but also the fact that I'm a museum director that has a studio fine arts degree that came through a program and education track is even more rare. So I'm one of a kind, you know, in that group. And it's just really rare to not be a PhD art historian or somebody that comes from a finance side that ends up in a director position. Now, I think that's going to change over time. But as of now, I'm kind of my own. I'm the only one.
And I guess, having kind of a new path for that, especially in a field that's so mired in tradition.
Right.
Not to mention that it's, you know, been predominantly male for so long, and that's finally starting to change, where you're seeing a lot more diversity. What were you expecting in terms of, you know, I remember your first day at the museum.
Right.
And now, you know, did you have any expectations? You'd been around museums. Obviously, you knew a lot of museum directors. But as you said, none of them were doing what you were doing. And in some ways, the fact that you're here now doing this is unlikely in many ways. What did you expect from this job? Is it something like, I'm going to get in there and it's going to be like this? Or what do you see?
In a lot of ways, it's been somewhat like I expected, but it's also because I expected Philbrook to be a little different too and not really like every other museum, because that was partly what attracted me to come here to begin with. And also that I knew that a museum that wanted to hire a director like me had to be approaching things a little bit differently too, or at least willing to do things differently. So part of it is that I had always kind of vowed, if I ever got the chance to be in this position, that I would do it differently. I didn't want to do it exactly like it's always been done. And that's been the same as when I've been a programmer or a curator too, but it's really, how do you have an impact with your audience? And seeing how audiences are shifting and what people want to have happen inside a museum is changing too. But it's been, I've been in a lot of places where that was an uphill battle. It was kind of pushing to kind of see it a different way and push both against tradition, push against expectations, push against maybe audience or even donors in some case. Here, that alignment was there, where everybody kind of had been and wanting to go in this new direction. So that's been really, really exciting. So you can come in and not only are people on the same page, they want to go there. And really my role is to, let's show you the way. And to give the confidence to kind of sell people on it, but also to kind of bring people along. Sometimes I'm the cheerleader, sometimes I'm the therapist, sometimes I'm the negotiator. But really what it is to provide that vision and provide that direction that people can do what they do best. And in the end, the biggest thing is we want to actually impact our audience. And that goes back to when I was 16 trying to make music, or when I was in my studio making art, or to now. The biggest thing is I want to actually have a difference in the community I'm in.
I have to imagine that you've gotten in trouble a lot doing things. It seems like you come from very much from a better to ask for forgiveness than permission kind of
that is
background.
A motto, yes.
But I wonder, what's an example of some you've told me a lot of crazy ideas you've had, and some things probably didn't work out. You know,
right.
What's something that didn't
work out?
You know, just kind of the dream was here and then the reality was over here and then the middle was just something else.
There's a lot of events that look really great on paper that the title is like awesome and you put a lot of work into it and like five people show up. And sometimes that's okay because those are the right five people. And sometimes those are ones you can talk about kind of later. And, you know, there's been, you know, over the years, there's been dozens of those where we've put in a lot of different work to things. I'm trying to think of an exact example of one, but one is like the very first music event I ever curated was a music festival in Rochester, Minnesota. It was out back of the Art Center there. And I was very young and naive. Instead of just doing like a concert for my first one, I'll do 12 bands on one day and we'll just jump in and do
a music
festival
of sorts.
So it was experimental music to kind of indie pop to things. And we did it. We pulled it off. But again, it was like a Friday afternoon in the middle of August. And I think the very first couple of bands played to an audience of like four people, three of which I was related to. And I still remember the band in the afternoon. It was this experimental noise band that I had booked as part of this event. And two of them were like my students. That's kind of how I got them in there. But they were like doing things like circular saws and garbage cans and miking it and doing like this like, you know, industrial noise thing to like nobody. There's like nobody in the audience except the public radio sponsor that we had. And these kids are pirate radio guys. So they're going on this rant against public radio because that's, of course, the big evil enemy there.
Yes.
And then they started spewing profanities and the cops came and it became this kind of whole thing. And the cops came over there. They're trying to shut this thing down. There's nobody there. But it creates such an interesting moment for the couple people who are there that story I still remember until now, you know, 14 years later.
Well, it seems like there's something fascinating about a complete disaster, and there's something fascinating about an unmitigated success, but there's very little interesting about lukewarm.
Right.
You know, and so a huge failure will be talked about forever. There's value to failure, and I know that you're kind of a big proponent of pushing people to feel comfortable about failing.
Right.
Because you're never going to get anywhere new without failing. But, you know, as a manager of people, which is also something that's kind of a new thing. I mean, you've got 75 people or so, you know, that work for you now, all with different needs and different styles and different personalities and all these things, all wanting in some way to please you as their boss in some certain way. If someone fails, you know, how do you deal with something like that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is that I hope I'm creating an environment where that is viewed as acceptable to do that. I think what we don't want to have is people to keep making the same mistake repeatedly over and over again, that you learn from it and go forward. But fear of failure is a good motivator to kind of to push, but it also should not be something that holds you back. Now, not everybody's wired that way. And I think that's part of one of those things that I recognize. And it's one of those things where I think, you know, I think you and I get along well because I think we're wired in a very similar way that way, that it's just kind of like, let's just try it, whatever, like just do it. And
to a fault sometimes.
To a fault. Yes. And, but I'd rather err to that side of things than be so cautious you don't ever try something. And So what I'm hoping is I can set up a nurturing environment where people feel like, one, they have that permission, and they know that when something doesn't go as planned, that they're supported, you know, in that too, is that we learn from it and we go forward, and it's a team. No one person's ever going to be put in that position where they're going to bear all the responsibility of anything that fails. And you need to set up an environment where that is understood, and it's also understood from a board level and a Dorn level too, that that's acceptable. You know, I like to say too, is if we aren't failing 25% of the time, we aren't pushing enough. We're being way too safe. The really good stuff, that really the stuff that changes the game, are those things that are that risk. And the people that, that actually crack that open and make that innovation are the people that are willing to make the risk. And nobody ever like changed things by being super safe. And now we want to make calculated risk at times too. That doesn't mean you just wildly do things without any plan. We do a lot of things with research and analytics and talking to people and understanding what the trends are in the field. But there are times where you just need to go forward with some faith that it could happen. But I think the key is this, where I really think the difference is like one, is like always looking for, no matter what you're doing, making sure the quality is at the top level that you can possibly make it. Do not settle for it being okay. And those little details, those tiny details that most people don't even recognize when they come into a program or an event or an exhibition, that's what makes the difference between good and great. And that could be everything from how you park your car, to the food that's in the restaurant, to how you interact with an exhibition, to the person that welcomes you at the front desk. Those little things have huge impact. We don't consciously think of them as much as like the main topic of the exhibition, but they actually make a big part of that overall experience. So looking at those things, like that's a big piece. And then it's also being able to recognize when something happens that you didn't anticipate or expect that's good, and to roll with it. And it's to be nimble with that. So there's a lot of times in the middle of an event, something may go awry that you're like, that's not what I expected. Right. But you see it as being good or being interesting, and you can instantly go with it.
I wonder, as you've been doing this for a year and having a personality that's very hands-on. You know, I've seen you at events moving chairs around and doing, you're very hands-on director. Part of that probably is because it's in your nature. Part of it's because you're just used to doing that as a programmer. You know, there's some of that built in. But I wonder, in terms of taking risks and doing new things for this museum, for Philbrook, have you throttled it back a little bit in the first year, trying to figure out who can handle this and what are people's limits? And, you know, has this first year in some ways been temperature taking in some regard?
A little bit. Not as much as I maybe even anticipated coming in, because I think when I came in, the staff and the city and our audience and the board was actually far more ready for it than I even had hoped coming in. So I think we've been able to go quicker in some ways than even thought that we would. But the one thing is you don't want to overreach with your audience too, because if they're not ready for something or they're in some ways, you need to kind of bring them along. And that's teaching them. It's kind of getting them on your side. You also need to kind of be able to kind of push them too. And that's pushing everybody a bit. And I know that we've been pushing the staff. And I mean, this is one of those things internally, I think that's been the biggest lesson for me, is learning kind of the overall pacing. And you know, some people are ready to go tomorrow and let's just push, push, push. And other people are like, they different motivations, different ways they work. They can't see maybe that vision as clearly as maybe I do. And they need to be brought along and they need to be given the tools to do that. So I think for me, it's been figuring out the overall pacing going forward and how I can bring different personalities, different types of people of different roles in the museum along together on this path. Not just like the programmers, not just the curators, but bringing, you know, everybody down to the janitors up through the board along this path, you know, together. So for me, it's been a bit of learning in that process about kind of overall what people can handle at what speed. You know, I think one specific example is I think about is like my tendency is to be very transparent and open about things. And when I came in, it was like, we're going to have meetings and we're going to have everybody involved and everybody's going to know everything from the beginning. Well, I realized pretty quickly is that, one, not everybody wants to know everything.
Not everybody wants to go to every meeting either.
They don't. So there's a fatigue that comes in that. And there's also some people like, can you please just tell me the four things I need to do and I can go on with my day? Like, all this other stuff, I don't need to know that.
Give me a list.
That's it. Yeah. So it's recognizing where you want to draw that line and also how do you create a small functional group that does have that transparency, that collaboration between departments, but doesn't have to be 30 people.
Right.
And that's become, we've kind of gone back and forth in some of those things, like learning what that pacing is, We've also come in and started a whole bunch of new processes internally to make exhibitions programs more collaborative. But as you know, being part of some of that, it's been kind of a back and forth as we figure it out.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Levels. Don't even think about hanging a piece of art without a handy level. Nothing bugs us more than walking into someone's house and seeing a bunch of crooked family photos. You're better than that. Get a level. Remember, it's not right until the bubble's in the middle. And if you're too lazy to get a real one, we're pretty sure there's an app for that.
Having the authority that comes with being a museum director, you've had so long so many ideas that you had to run up the flagpole. You don't really have to run it up the flagpole anymore. You are the flagpole.
Kind of.
There's a board and stuff still, but I think that, you know, having that ultimate say on things, and I'm sure you've had a list of things that you've always wanted to try, and one of them is the show we're doing, Museum Confidential, the show from which this podcast gets its name, but it's something you've talked about wanting to do for a long time. So the general idea is, what is a museum, right?
Right. It's really kind of pulling the curtain back. So people so often come in and ask questions about, you know, what does a curator do? What's your collection that you never show? You know, what are those, you know, stories that you don't normally tell? And so often museums are very protective about not talking about those things for whatever silly reason, I feel, to not do that. And so what this show does, it kind of pulls the curtain back and talks about some of those things. It really describes like what makes up the museum. And I think people really, honestly, for the most part, don't know. They think of like a museum as maybe that kind of like stuffy archive where objects go and they get stored there. And I went on a fourth grade field trip there and it was fine. And I haven't been back since. So the show is kind of to talk to some of our core audience and show some things that they've never seen before and really kind of speak to that depth. But also for those people that maybe have never been to a museum before, or haven't been in some time, it's like, how do we dispel the myth of it being not interesting, something that feels more closed off,
stuffy,
and that the objects kind of go to die there, that they just end, they go into the collection and they're done.
Yeah, art morgue. Yeah,
that's it. So what the show is doing is talking about basically the six components that make up a museum. So it's the curators, it's the research that we're constantly doing about artwork, it's the collection, it's the artists that we work with, and we work with a lot of living artists. It's the programming that we do, it knits all that together. And the last piece is the audience. The audience helps complete all that and are a big part of it. If it wasn't for the audience or the people coming, there would be no point of having the museum.
Right. People are going to get a chance to curate some stuff.
They will.
They're going to get a chance to do a little bit of research or maybe more of an investigation into things. And they're going to get a chance to see stuff they've never seen before. The average museum, you said, shows maybe 5% of what they have. And so the idea here is, what's the other 95%? Where is the other 95%? Can we see the other 95%?
Right.
And we're going to show them some of that stuff.
So we're going to, you know, dozens of items that have rarely have ever been out of the basement. So you're going to see that other 95%. You will get your opportunity to help curate a show. But learn what the choices the curators make. And, you know, curators don't just pick the stuff they like. Curators are just telling a story. So they're trying to pick the artwork that best tells that story. So you're going to be pulled into that world and help make some of those choices. But you're also going to find out that often we'll take an object into the collection and we learn later some very different information about it. Sometimes it's technology that does that. X-ray technology comes on and we can, you know, look at an ancient Egyptian, you know, mummy and know a lot more about it than we did before. Sometimes it's learning actually just like from research of flipping the painting on the backside and seeing where it's been. And finding some things like that, that doesn't look right. You dig it a little bit deeper and you find out a whole different story. Artwork and museums have a lot of stories to tell, of which times we're just scratching the surface. And those are the things I get super excited about. I know you do too.
About telling stories.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I want to be that thing where you kind of invite people in and you say, and this is what this show is. Like, say, hey, come over here. I want to show you this thing. Nobody's ever seen this. I want to show you this thing. And I think it's really cool. I think you're going to find it really cool here. And here's why. This is that kind of show. Like, we have a suit of samurai armor. We're going to show that. That's cool.
Well, I mean, the concept of stories, I tell people this all the time. There's this famous trope that says, you know, tell me the truth and I'll believe it. Tell me a fact and I'll learn it. But if you tell me a story, it'll live inside me forever. I'm paraphrasing that. But that's the idea. The other thing is this behind-the-scenes culture. A lot of people think that reality television was the birth of this, or people, you know, watching Dirty Jobs, or they're watching some other thing. But I was talking to somebody the other day about Mr. Rogers, which I used to love to watch. I'm sure you did too. Every time I ask someone what their favorite Mr. Rogers episode was, 7 out of 10 people say the time you went to the crayon factory.
It's the crayon factory.
Yes, the crayon factory is the one. And I remember that yellow crayon, that wax, you know, I can but getting to see that, and maybe it was because crayons are such a huge part of a kid's life.
Yeah.
And you have no idea that things even get made. You think they just exist.
Exactly.
And so, you know, it's like the birds and the bees of things. You know, you get to see the whole background and stuff. So getting to get that behind the scenes look on a level like has never happened before at this museum, and maybe not at any museum.
Well, and this is, we know that there hasn't really been a show like this that we are aware of that's out there. And for whatever reason. And we don't want this to be some sort of navel-gazing thing, too, so we're just like, oh, so impressed with ourselves. We're talking about the museum. It's not about that at all. It's more about talking about those things like the crayon factory. I love that episode, too.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, it's the same way I love now, like, watching, you know, with my kids, things like Modern Marvels on History Channel and how it's made and, like, things where it takes you into, like, I want to know, like, how you make that car or even, like, common items, how that's made. But museum is the same way. Like, how do we make crates to ship out really valuable artwork? Those are custom made in-house. They're super complicated how a lot of them are made. And we have our, you know, we have technicians that is their job.
Yeah, artisans in a way.
Absolutely. You know? And it's thinking about those things. Like, I never thought that working in a museum was even a job I even thought of, even in grad school. And it came later. And all these jobs that really weren't even, like, visible as options, you know, for whatever reason. And then when you get into a museum, you realize there's people that do things that are registrars that, you know, take care of the artwork. There's people that are designers that work inside of museums. And I think that's often people don't think about even those layers, all the way down to people that, you know, help work on our weddings that we have in there. There's all these different things that happen inside this thing that is the museum. And we want to talk about all of that.
Yeah, it's like a little ant farm, you know. There's so many things that make up the whole. So I think people are going to have a great time at this show. They're going to see things they've never seen. They're going to do things. That's part of the thing. It's not just a seeing show. It's a doing show. And I think museums in general seem to be moving towards that space where it's participatory and not just observational.
Right. And I mean, it's doing to such a point. So we have an artist in residence, Andy Doucette, that's going to be, he's based in Minneapolis. He's going to come back and forth a few times during the run of the show. But he's also going to be communicating to us and changing his installation over the run of the exhibition. And what he's really interested in, again, it comes back to the storytelling. He's making a motel lobby when you first come in that will be having, like, souvenirs in it. So thinking about travel and souvenir being another way that we collect objects that hold a story. So it doesn't matter what that trinket is that you got at the Statue of Liberty. It's the fact that when you grab it, you think about that trip that you took to the Statue of Liberty.
Well, I hope people will come to the show, check it out. It's going to be fun. There's going to be so many things to do, events, pop-up things, all kinds of different things. So we're really excited about that. And we're going to end with a little bit of a lightning round here.
All right, great.
All right, so it's just a, you got to pick one. You ready to go?
Done.
All right, New Order or Joy Division?
Joy Division. Well, I like them both, but Joy Division.
All right, Julian Schnabel or Basquiat?
Basquiat.
Prince
or
Michael Jackson?
Prince.
Now, we need to tell people you're
from Minnesota.
Okay, so there's a bias there.
Yeah, and I've actually seen Prince a few times. And, like, I am very biased, but still, I will stand by Prince.
And then Fleer or Topps?
Oh, Topps.
Now, this is an inside, truly inside
baseball. It's a baseball thing. Upper Deck is how it would take over both.
How many baseball cards do you have, by the way?
Still now?
Yeah.
I probably
have. Do you have a ballpark number?
20,000 maybe, still.
20,000? Yeah. Is that decreased?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think the peak number was?
Volume of cards. I probably had well over 150,000 at one point.
150,000 baseball cards.
Yeah. But this is, I was working in the industry too. So I was working in a baseball card shop and, like, I sold a bunch of stuff on eBay. My first baseball card
collection. You're a dealer.
I was a dealer. I was a dealer. So I was the kid on the bus. So back when I was a kid, I would go on with a bunch of, growing up in Minnesota, a bunch of Twins cards, which really weren't worth that much. And I would trade people for all of their kind of, like, Don Mattingly's and other.
Here's,
like,
my
cards.
Kirby Puckett.
For exactly. Here's a Kirby Puckett, and you're going to give me, like, your Jose Canseco rookie cards are worth a lot more at the time. And I would just stockpile, you know, cards. So I sold my first collection, and which was, like, late 80s stuff, and bought my first car. And my second collection, when I was doing a lot of stuff on, I was, like, late 90s. I paid for part of grad school with that collection. So back then, that was when eBay was, like, humming, right? So there's a lot more people buying than people selling. So I would look at things, my kind of things that I really concentrated on was people that went to really obscure colleges. So if you find players like an offensive lineman, but he went to school like in Bozeman, Montana or something like that, there's a guy out there that collects those. And I'm the only guy that's putting them online. So I'm buying stuff for 5 cents and getting $15 for them. And because you know your market. So back in that era, I would be buying up like 25, 50, 100 of a certain one card of a certain player, hoping that they would hit. It's like the stock market, but doing it with sports players. And at the real peak of it, when eBay was doing really well, I would prospect football players, like before their game on Sunday. I'd buy the cards. I'd try to buy the auction on Monday, relist the auction on Tuesday, and then they would go through the weekend and hopefully they have a good game on Sunday. And the auction would close on Sunday night.
This is getting kind of weird now.
Isn't it? Yeah. And then I would have the first guy send it to the third guy. You open the door.
In the art world, obviously, people are worried about fakes all the time. Yeah. Are there fakes in the baseball card world?
Tons. And the thing I would never buy a Michael Jordan rookie unless you really look at it. There's a ton of fakes of those out there.
So that's our tip for the day.
Yeah. Don't buy Michael Jordan rookies, but unless it's been authentic.
Don't do it. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
In 1945, an American soldier named Joe Meter stole 8 medieval artifacts found in a German mineshaft, hidden by local members of the clergy from Nazi looters. Returning to the United States, the artifacts remained in his possession until his death in 1980. He made no attempt to sell them. When his brother and sister attempted to sell a 9th century manuscript and a 16th century prayer book in 1990, the two were arrested and charged. However, the charges were dismissed after it was declared the statute of limitations had expired. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.